accession number 18662, Reel 1.
Admiral Garrett's Reel 1. Can we imagine we're back in 1945 with VJ Day over and done with? And can you tell me, please, what your first naval experiences were after that?
Certainly. I'd been discharged from hospital after having surgery on my head wound in the spring, and I went back to HMS St George over in the Isle of Man and continued to serve at this boys' training establishment until the late autumn, when I was sent on leave pending a new appointment, which turned out to be to HMS Somerys, the destroyer flotilla leader based at Plymouth, recently returned from the Far East, and I was to be the first lieutenant, the executive officer of the ship for her new commission. And I joined her in December 1945 on a characteristically wet Plymouth evening when she was lying alongside the coaling jetty. Not that she needed coal, but that's where she seemed to be.
Who was the captain of that ship? Who was the captain of the ship?
The captain of the ship for the new commission had already joined, and his name was Captain W.H. Selby, DSC, a very experienced destroyer officer. He was generally known as Joe Selby, and we were, I think, at that time, his 8th command.
What impression did the ship make on you?
The ship, as I said, was recently returned from the Far East, so she was a hard-worked destroyer with a number of repairs and maintenance tasks to be carried out. And this was our task for the next 2 or 3 months in Plymouth, working with the dockyard to get ourselves ready for service in the Mediterranean. And we sailed from Plymouth in March and joined the Mediterranean fleet in April after a limited workup. And we worked up further in Malta for service on the Palestine Patrol, which was a chief task at that time for the destroyers and frigates and sloops of the Mediterranean Fleet.
What did the Palestine Patrol involve?
The purpose of the Palestine Patrol was to stop illegal immigration into the High Commission territories, which were under the United Nations. I think we need to tidy that up, can we?
It's a mandate.
It's a mandate, yes.
Don't worry about tidying up.
Well, we'll put us aside for that. To give you an idea of the problem, there was a very carefully established organization for shipping refugees from camps all over Europe through Italy, particularly into Palestine, to provide new homes for these displaced persons of Jewish origin, and also to reinforce the strength of the Zionist organization in Palestine. Equally, of course, the Arab population was considerably concerned not to see this reinforcement, and the British were the buffer between the two opposing views, and the job which we had to do was the thankless one of standing between two opposing views. And I must explain that the resistance to our patrols was very vicious, and therefore the things we had to learn was how to board small vessels outside the 3 mile limit, inside the 3 mile limit off the Palestine coast. So the job had to be done quickly, and the ships were fitted with wire netting covering the whole of the forecastle and B gun deck to receive the missiles which were thrown by the illegal immigrants, and the boarding parties had to be equipped with steel helmets, gas masks, body shields, what are called athletic supports, shin pads, and they were armed with handguns and truncheons, because it was an extremely unpleasant experience for a young man to have to jump from his ship onto another ship and to be attacked thereafter by the people on board, and many of them women, which of course was extremely distasteful.
Did you immediately have to cope with that type of situation?
Not like many a patrol, it was not something that happened every day. The normal procedure was that some information would be received, and we'd intensify our patrols perhaps for that period, and sure enough there would be evidence of a movement, and we'd then find ourselves shadowing an illegal immigrant ship. To give you a good instance, there was one ship which was a corvette. I don't know whether it was an ex-British corvette, but it was of corvette size, and it carried 1,300 people in addition to its crew. If one can imagine a ship of that size with 1,300 people, you can also imagine that probably one of the ways in which we could confirm a sighting was to get upwind of the ship, and get downwind of the ship, and you would then confirm that it was carrying more than it should be. And the ship was duly arrested by us, and the immigrants were safely unloaded in Haifa and shipped to Cyprus, where the camps had been established for their reception. And then gradually they would be fed into Palestine in accordance with the immigration policy that applied at the time. Well, the next ship then came, and it was precisely a similar ship, and it had 2,600 people on board. And the people who organized this were obviously utterly ruthless, because they kind of had no concern for the safety or well-being of the people that they were sending in these enormous numbers in these totally inadequate vessels. However, we succeeded in arresting this second vessel, and the same procedure was used. I took no part, because it was after my time, in the famous episode. I think it's recorded in a book called Exodus, when a much larger vessel called the President Moorfield was arrested by a cruiser, which they had to use because the destroyer was too small for the size of the ship. And I think there were some 4,000 plus in that ship. But that was also safely brought in. Meantime, one night we were on patrol and I was the officer watch with two officers with me, and we found a suspicious echo on the radar amongst a number of fishing vessels, and we plotted this, and eventually we decided that this was possibly an immigrant vessel. But when we got close, it was in fact proceeding rather faster than we'd thought, and it eventually, as we closed, it eventually collided with our stern, which was an embarrassment for me as the officer watch, and I was subsequently informed by the commander-in-chief that I wish to be more careful in future. But meantime, the vessel heeled away, and we sent a boarding party across at first light, and sure enough, it had landed immigrants some hours before we contacted it. The evidence was clearly to be seen in the rations and life-saving equipment, such as it was, the odd lifebelts which were lying around in the disgustingly overcrowded quarters in this small vessel which had crept down the Turkish coast and down the coast from Syria.
Did you personally witness scenes of violence?
Yes. When we were boarding, yes. Throwing of missiles and the boarding party having to force their way on board.
What kind of casualties occurred on either side?
We never had any particular evidence of casualties amongst the immigrants, although there were pictures taken by American magazines, but at the same time evidence was available of the victims being prepared for photography with bloodstained bandages and so on being available. So there was a good deal of propaganda on all sides in this particular aspect.
You mean they were concocted casualties?
Oh, yes. The only casualty that I can immediately remember is very unpleasant damage to a chap's face when he was hit by a bully beef tin as he went on board. But that's the only thing that I can particularly remember.
What damage was done to his face?
It broke his nose.
How did the men who had to carry out the task view it?
Well, they had been trained in the techniques of actually getting on board and of using minimum force to get their own way, to get the command of the wheel in the ship and the engine room telegraph so that the vessel could be controlled. One can only say it was a distasteful task. It's just the sort of thing that our soldiers... Now, it's quite interesting that propaganda always referred to the British soldiers coming on board, and I read a book quite recently which refers throughout to soldiers. Now, the reason for that is that you can say what you like about British soldiers, but you mustn't say rude things about British sailors for reasons which go back almost to the days of Cromwell, that the British Army, because of the Sergeant Major Generals, got a bad reputation in England, and whereas the Royal Navy has always been held in particular esteem. And I'm not saying this because I'm a sailor, I'm saying this as a matter of fact. And they always, you'll find the references are always to British soldiers. Well, there were no soldiers being employed. They were ordinary Royal Navy sailors who were having to carry out this distasteful task. And they were joined, when they arrived in Haifa, by soldiers then who took on the responsibility for guarding the immigrants.
Sailors rather than Marines?
Sailors. Oh, yes, because the destroyers don't carry Marines. Yes, good point. The cruiser eventually, when the President Warfield had to be dealt with, perhaps they used Marines then, but it wasn't normal. In any case, there's a distinction between a Royal Marine and a soldier, but that distinction is never made. They don't say the Marines then came, they all said that the soldiers then came. An aside?
Certainly.
Paducah is the name of the book, or the sailing, something. I've got it written down. I can find it for you, because that is the latest book I've read on this subject. And it's very interesting to see from that side the organization which, as I described, was providing all these poor souls with a possible escape from the horrors of Europe to what they literally thought was the promised land, which it wasn't.
How were the sailors supposed to use minimum force?
Well, I think elbows and a tap with a club rather than... We didn't have firearms used, as far as I'm aware, not in any event. But it was a very difficult job to get on board and to achieve control of these different vessels.
But the main thing was to get control of the wheel.
And the engine room telegraphs, the engine room controls. So you had people going up to the bridge and people going down to the engine room.
And so you were, in your own personal experience, you were dealing with about 3 immigrant ships.
I would think those were the active cases that I immediately can recall. To give you an idea of the circumstances, we had our ships had to be examined regularly in Haifa by, strangely enough, a unit led by a Lieutenant Commander Crabb. And we had to carry out procedures for the prevention of underwater attack when we were in harbour. And I can remember we had to be ready to get underway at very short notice. And one occasion, I remember one destroyer got underway in about 15 minutes from a 4 hours notice, which was pretty swift, in order that you could get out and shake any magnetic attachment, explosive attachment, shake it off by the movement of the water.
Did you ever go aboard the immigrant ships yourself?
No. That was a task for the boarding officer.
What rank would he have?
Lieutenant. RNVR in our case, as a matter of fact.
Any other incidents you recollect during these duties?
No, I don't. There were, of course, incidents going on ashore, but they and our movements were restricted by the situation. The organisations which were involved were the Haganah, which is the Israeli, the Zionist army, the Ergens Vailumi, who were an active unit, and I've forgotten, three men. And we used to...
Stern Gang?
The Stern Gang was in the background, yes. Maybe that was the one I was thinking of. But I seem to remember there were 3 main organisations, of which the Haganah was the broadest, and the IZL was the next, and maybe the Stern Gang was the top. I can't remember now. And our operations were directed from the office, the headquarters of the Commodore Palestine, who was a senior naval officer, obviously. And he was fed with information which directed where the patrol should be.
So we're talking about the summer of 1946?
Yes. And we then went back to Malta, and for the record, we did another patrol in the following year, but I'll come to that chronologically. We then had a period in Malta, and we then set sail for what is called, was called at that time, the second summer cruise. The fleet then scattered to eastern Mediterranean ports with the idea of assembling for the fleet regatta at Argostoli in the Greek islands in October. And we went to... I have to think where we were.
Don't worry, maybe we'll come back to you later. somewhere in the Greek island?
I don't remember the sequence, that's the trouble. But the point is that at one stage we were ordered to visit Corfu, and we were there with the flag officer, 1st Cruiser Squadron in HMS Mauritius, and the cruiser Leander in company, and our own flotilla mate, HMS Volage. And we all sailed from there on the 22nd of October 1946 to make a passage through the Corfu Channel, which had been the subject of dispute. And I now await directions. How much do you want me to go into this?
In detail, please, because it's quite a famous incident.
During earlier in the year, two of our ships had been making a passage through the Corfu Channel, and they'd been fired on by Albanian shore batteries. And there'd been a good deal of diplomatic remonstrance about this. And the Foreign Office took a fairly strong line. And, of course, the Admiralty were naturally determined to sustain the principle of the innocent passage through international straits. And the Corfu Channel straits had been swept under the Allied mine clearance program during the previous year, from 45 onwards. And so it was decided eventually by the government that an opportunity should be taken of testing whether the Albanians were still against free passage, and we were ordered to proceed through the channel on our way to Argostoli. It wasn't necessarily the direct route, but it was that's what was to be done. And so with HMS Mauritius leading, Saumarez astern of her, Leander astern of Saumarez, and Volage astern of Leander, we set off through the channel during the afternoon of the 22nd of October. And at 2:46, there was a loud explosion which seriously damaged HMS Saumarez, and we lost power and drifted out of the swept channel, and Mauritius went on her way. Leander and Volage passed, and then Volage turned to join us, and Volage then came and tried to take us in tow, and we managed to pass the tow with some difficulty because we were on fire. The water was on fire because of oil and oil fuel igniting. And the tow had just been passed, and the weight taken by Volage, and she was proceeding to tow us back towards in the direction of Corfu, when there was another heavy explosion, and she slipped the tow, and it was seen that her bows had gone, and in fact the bows eventually tore clear. Otherwise, her stability was seriously impaired. But once the bows had been shorn off by the weight of metal, she then returned and sought to take us in tow over the broken bow. And they placed heavy mats to take the chafe of the tow over these sharp metals. And they also had made use of a special dockyard tow rope with a strong Manila spring in it, and that ultimately the tow was passed. She was able to take the weight, and with the immediate prospect of finding other mines, we were towed out and ultimately back to Corfu. during the evening, we were supported by HMS Raider, who came alongside our bow and played water on the fires in our forward part. And the gunnery officer and I were got rid of some of the ammunition on the B gun deck, which was getting rather hot. The radar did a wonderful job by keeping herself alongside us in the dark, in miserable conditions. So we got back to Corfu, and initially we were, the Volage was taken in tow by Leander, who was at anchor. She managed to get up and receive a wire from Leander. And then, so we had Leander, Volage, and us all lying like three ducks on a string. Meantime, HMS Ocean had sent over a firefighting team. They'd sent us sandwiches and some hot drinks, because we had no power for heating or anything of that sort. Our doctor was dealing with our casualties on the area near the torpedo tubes, and we'd spread an awning over them to keep the rain off, and firefighting was going on continuously. And thereafter, the fleet constructor and his colleagues came and examined the ship, and it was decided that she was not fit to tow to Malta. The Volage was dispatched to Malta, being towed, it was decided to leave us alongside HMS Ranpura, the destroyer depot ship, repair ship. And it took them 6 weeks to prepare the ship for towing, which suggested to me that they hadn't enough faith in the handiwork of British naval constructors. It took as much explosive to blow the bows off as it had to blow the ship up in the first place. And so there was a bit of a laugh on that account in fleet circles. It would have been much better if we'd been towed to Malta, and if we'd sunk on the way, it would have been less ignominious than the spectacle of one of Her Majesty's ships, His Majesty's ships, being towed into Malta with no bows, which had been cut off by us, as opposed to by an explosion of the enemy like the Volage. And in fact, we were, the ship was lying in Malta dockyard for at least 3 years after that, as then she was taken out and sunk.
Were the casualties very bad?
We had 44 casualties in the two, 44 fatal casualties in the two ships, of which 38 were in the Somerys, and I cannot remember the number of other casualties, which were fractures and burns and flash injuries.
Do you think it should have been anticipated that the Albanians might have mined the channel?
No, I think that's beyond expectations. The only thing that perhaps might have been an ordinary routine precaution in restricted waters was that the cruisers might have towed paravanes. You know, the